and asked them, and one of the comments I got was probably from agricultural electric fencing. Anyway, so this is a worldwide problem, and it does not seem to be limited to urban areas. WB2BX, so go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of EMI out there for different reasons, but I mean, one of the most common, unfortunately, for us urban livers is just the endless electromagnetic noise. All the equipment that we run is leaky, and it just spreads the background no matter what you do. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure in plans there's some guy with a piece of equipment that splatters RF as well. But I mean, in Brooklyn and metropolitan areas in general, it seems to be all over the place. And there's really nothing much you can do. You can, like I said, set up a dream antenna. You can't expect zero noise floor in Brooklyn. At least I've never. If I see a zero noise floor on my receiver, I immediately look if the antenna is connected.
That's a good one.
Yeah, it's a true one, too. Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, boy. You know, out here we have less people. We don't have as high buildings all around us. I'm out in Ronkonkoma. So, of course, that's an advantage for us. You have to overcome all the buildings surrounding you. I'm sure not in every spot in Brooklyn. Out here on the island, too, you know, we have some crowded areas. Some of those people might have some problems. Also, power lines. You know, I've heard a lot of guys out here complain about they're too close to the power lines and that affects them. In my neighborhood, you know, like, well, Dick looked around for high elevation. You know, I found a place with underground wire service, so maybe that might help. Also, land. You know, I have just enough land to put up like a meter antenna, not 160, but 80. Where that's pretty hard. You know, a dipole. So that's a little bit more difficult, I'm sure, in Brooklyn. Now you could do it. You could zigzag it here and zigzag it there. You know, I run mine diagonally, so naturally I have a good 80-meter system for especially for nighttime operations. So I guess all those things come into play. Wherever you are, you got to make do with what you got and try to overcome whatever problem you might have. But I would say that I've never really compared, you know, my area with, you know, a guy operating in the city. You know, everybody manages one way or another. You know, they have their favorite bands, their favorite modes, you know. Anyway, back to you, Roy. WS to us.
Okay, very good, Paul. Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, you try to live, as best you can. If you really must have a much lower noise floor, if it's really that important to a person, that move away. You know, they make aliyah to Arizona, like a lot of retirees have done in the past, and they do that for telescopy as well. That's there's a lot less sky pollution, you know, light pollution in places like Arizona than in Brooklyn or. I know people with telescopes who are not having a fun time with their telescopes in Queens. So, you know, you make the best of any situation. So, have you got the gist of the situation, Sam?
Yes, I do. One last question, if I may. Elevation. If you're up 1,100 feet versus sea level, makes a significant difference?
Probably. You know, I mean, the higher you are, the better you are within reason.
Thank you very much. I at least now have a better understanding why it's so miserable here in Brooklyn with some aspects of ham radio. But we make the most of it, right? Thank you very much, Roy. Have a good evening.
Thank you. You too, Sam. Yeah, we try our best, you know. Don't cry over spilled milk. Anyway, I guess it's time for you, Wes. What do you got for us tonight?
Okay. Nothing so tough, you know. In Tuesday, we had the news about Guatemala big disaster that could have happened. So Fuego volcano erupted. It was June 3rd, 2018 also when it erupted, but at that time there was 200 dead, 1.7 million people were affected, and 3,100 people evacuated. So I thought it would be something of this magnitude, but it wasn't. That's, but they sent the information to Paul in hope that Paul is going to say more about it, but I don't believe there is much to talk about it. It was a danger, but when I was searching for the information, I found the information about Belize. I was kind of surprised. I mean, it was something that was ringing in my head, but I didn't know it is Belize. Dr. Roy, does it ring the bell to you too, and to Xia?
I don't quite understand what you say.
Okay. So when I was looking at Guatemala, I wanted to know more about this area. So I was looking at Mexico, Honduras, El Salvador, and I wanted to find out where exactly is that volcano that erupted. But then I got across Belize, B-E-L-I-Z-E. And it was kind of new to me. I mean, I've heard about it, but I wasn't really, if somebody caught me by surprise, I wouldn't be able to interact. So my question to you was, is Belize ringing the bell for you too, and to extend?
Yeah, it's a Central American country. It's a small country. It's not really particularly famous or anything. I think the capital is Belize City, which makes it very good for school kids because it's November. But otherwise, not particularly different than the rest.
WS to one.
Yes, Paul.
It's supposed to be noted for like scuba diving, like super clear water, and people go down there for that. And once in a while, you'll see a lot of DX people trying to get DX contact with Belize. You know, they'll have a group of hands that'll go down there, and you know, they'll stay in you know, nice facilities. You know, set up big antennas, and you know, I know Belize is pretty common for that, but it's really noted for scuba diving. Back to you.
Yeah, it has a barrier reef. It has a long length of Caribbean sea coast, and also dense jungle. So it has all kinds of things. But I mean, I would assume that if you looked up most of Central America, they pretty much all sort of described that way.
I'm looking up. It was the British Honduras, one of them, years ago, then they switched to Belize.
Yeah, I gave up memorizing countries when they started to change their names all over the darn place. And they changed the major cities, because they didn't like the pronunciation the way the English was, and, you know, it probably wreaked havoc with the map industry.
Yeah, I had a problem to pronounce it to Belize. I think Polish pronounce it Belize. Okay. Anyhow, 4 times smaller than the state of New York. Or 5 times smaller, maybe. Independence since 1981. There were 1,500 British troops standing there because Guatemala wanted that land. Anyhow. any other comments about police? Okay, let me go to the next one. Hackers. Did I send? Yes, I sent it only to Roy. Hackers use hotel Wi-Fi to steal guests. Microsoft 365 accounts. I'm not sure if everybody knows what is Microsoft 365 accounts. So, Russian, what can I expect from Russia? Microsoft says Russian-backed hackers have been compromising some hotel Wi-Fi networks and using fake Microsoft 365 login pages to steal travelers' usernames and passwords. In some cases, they also push fake browser or OS update screen to trick people into installing malware. Did you hear about it, Dr. Ray?
Not particularly, but this is a well-known type of attack. This is what VPNs are made for. You know, if you're going to go to an external shared access point, use a VPN. It encrypts your information getting into and out of websites. And also, whenever you get a link, check what the link says. Often it's rather obvious that the link has a domain that doesn't make any sense because it's just a generic throwaway link that hackers are using to steal stuff from you. Do not assume that the legitimate companies are telling you to log into their account. It is very rare and far between where that is the case. Most of the times they deal with it in a secure means. So this is an ongoing thing. People have been pulling this crap for 30 years.
Okay. The question is, why Russia? What those gentlemen, in parentheses, wanted from American hotels?
It's very simple. They want money.
So, they want money, we may say. Those Russians are thieves, are criminals. We could use the word bandit. Could we use more compliments? And to agree.
Unfortunately, there are many, many thieves and scoundrels who are spending most of their lives trying to figure out scams through the Internet. You know, it's a simple process. You connect to the Internet with any kind of port sniffer, and immediately you get pinged by tens of hundreds of different sites looking for an open port to and different ways to scam you. You know, they send you email that they have a spy camera and you've been doing naughty things, and if you don't pay them in cryptocurrency, they're going to expose you to your boss or any variation. You know, they're not really doing the Nigerian scam too much anymore because they kind of burnt that out. But, I mean, every day is an assault by thieves and scoundrels, unfortunately.
Yeah, I was able to feed them myself. In 2011, I was in Tbilisi, Georgia, Europe. Not Georgia, United States, Georgia, Europe. And that was after your attempt of poisoning me in the airplane by Russians. Those Russians, not all Russians, those particular Russians. Anyhow, there was a humongous activity trying to steal whatever I had, not only from my phone. But anyhow, yes, I agree with everything what you say. The next one, simple questions. And the simple question is, I mean, there are simple questions. Where the 110 volts comes from? Anybody wants to say? Okay. Dr. Roy.
You want me to answer it? It's a historical and arbitrary number. You wrote it up. You could present it. I mean, it could easily have been 117 volts. It's not like... I find much better to have the question, you know, why are the cables that we use 50 ohms of impedance as opposed to 45 or 68? There's a reason why one is too high and the other is too low. But when it comes to voltage chosen, again, it's an arbitrary number. It could have just as easily been different by, you know, 10, 12, 15, 17. It's just, you know, some guy kind of said, well, you got to give us some voltage value. And they said, okay, 100.
Thank you very much for that. Well, the sources say different things, but usually they agree that Thomas Edison was the one who favored a lower voltage for safety reasons. Was it safety reason or was just that Nikola Tesla was a very Nikis empire? But anyhow, that was the story. Why do households have 220 volts? That means we say two-phase systems instead of three-phase systems. Anybody wants to answer the question? Okay, Dr. Roy.
Well, again, it's somewhat arbitrary, but you have to understand that the utilities were wiring the country, including industrial places and families. Family electricity, especially back in those days, you know, all they really needed was enough power to light up a light bulb. But factories had motors and all kinds of things. And they came to the conclusion that it was best case scenario to have a phase system with higher voltage potentials. By the way, it's kind of strange that Edison had anything to say about the voltage potentials of utilities, because if it was up to him, we would have had the current going through our utility line. He used to put on a show killing animals to demonstrate that alternating current was much more dangerous than direct current.
Yeah, also I don't believe that he was an inventor who was employing guys and taking all of their works to his own. And anyhow, then on what 50 hertz came from. So my understanding is that the two-phase system requires three wires, so it's more money spent. So those guys came to the conclusion that the most important for them is to earn money from the clients, so give them to 20, they don't need three phase, they don't need four wires, or three wires, whatever. So that was probably the cause. Now, the next question would be, 50 hertz comes from where? Why do we use 50 hertz or 60 hertz? What was the historical context? Dr. Roy.
Again, it's arbitrary. Europe, 50 hertz. You know, UK, if you go to the UK, the power is 50 hertz. And also, I think something like 200 and change volts. America chose, you know, they looked at their watch and they said, let's do 60 cycles a second.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. I was digging into it, and I found that Nikola Tesla advocated for 60 hertz, believing it provided a stronger and more reliable electrical system. So it was just a simple belief. Thomas Edison, who was his opponent, supported 50 hertz, arguing it was safer and more cost-effective, despite some of his demonstration suggesting otherwise. How does electrostatic fan work? Anybody wants to answer the question? Okay. So we have electrostatic fan. Dr. Roy.
Well, I'm not thrilled with the description that you extracted. There's different ways to interpret it. Up until recently, there were air filters that were electrostatic that actually circulated air without any motor, without any fans. It was basically just electrostatic fields that charged up small particles and then ran it through a gradient, which caused the particles to kind of accelerate towards the outside of the filter assembly. I haven't really seen too many effective fans using that method. Almost all of the ones that I've seen have been glorified air filters that had a lot of problems. These things generate ozone, which is not a healthy gas. And so it went out of practice. The company that manufactured a lot of them, a sharper image, I think, basically faded away years ago.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, did you guys ever see a Dyson fan that came off as a type of a thing? Because then when I looked into it, they had this loop that came out of the main body, main body of it, and a million little holes, and the air would be coming out of that, and they were coming across as like it was some kind of a electrostatic type of something out of the Jetsons, but it wasn't. All it was that there was a fan in the body of it, and the air was being pushed through the tube that went around. So it wasn't a scam, but it was kind of like, false advertising. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, I actually own one of those things. It's nothing special. The fan, as you said, is in the base. It's just a Venturi tube that hides the blade movements. That's all.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. Thank you very much, Roy, for that. It is the iron wind generator, like you said, right? It uses wind to move charged particles across electric fields, generating electrical energy without any moving parts. And you said precisely the same. But now we have a question. How does electrostatic fan, which is that ion wind generator, differ from ion engine? Maybe Paul would be able also to say a few words.
Can't help you unless you describe what this electrostatic fan. I'm not even sure what that is. Back to you, Buzz.
Yeah, so we have electrostatic fan, doesn't have moving parts. And then we have ion engine. So electrostatic fan is ion wind generator. And electrostatic and ion engine is also using electrostatic field. So what is the difference between the two? Back to you, Paul.
intensity.
Okay. I read a lot about the ion engines, but you can't. I know one thing, you can't operate an ion engine in your living room. It has to be out in a vacuum to work, that's for sure.
Yeah, you said the magic word, vacuum. So an electrostatic fan uses an electric field to move air, while ion engine generates thrust by accelerating ions from propellant gas, typically in vacuum of space. Dr. Roy, for your comment?
Okay. I mean, it's not terribly efficient.
Definitely you're right. Absolutely you're right. With time, it does what we expect to be done. A walkie-talkie antenna. Walkie-talkie antenna receives signal from another walkie-talkie. If the power of that signal, 1/360th of the total power of the transmitter. I'm going to repeat the question again. So we have two walkie-talkie. One walkie-talkie is receiving signal from another walkie-talkie. And the question is the power of that signal representing 1/360th of the total power of the transmitter? Anybody has the answer, or maybe Dr. Roy would like to say a few words?
Pray tell, where did you get the 360 from?
No, that was my question. I didn't take that question from anywhere. It was my question. We have a vertically polarized monopole. It is spreading signal equally. So we take 1 degree, 360 degrees. That 1 degree will have 1/360th of the power of the transmitter. Right or wrong?
Why are you taking 1 degree? You're using arbitrary units. We were talking about Edison and his arbitrary numbers. You're just using your arbitrary numbers. They're more common. They're, a compass, but there's no particularly value in a degree. They simply kind of decided to divide it up by 360 because the Babylonians had a fixation on things divisible by 12 and 60 and 360 and such. But it's arbitrary.
Well, sometimes when we formulate a question, we want to lead to a certain answer. And I wanted to lead to the answer that is that we have two walkie-talkies at the distance. We want to know how much power the other walkie-talkie is receiving from that first walkie-talkie. Back to you, Andrew.
Okay, that's effectively a function of the power and of the distance between the two. You know, inverted square and all?
That's right. And also we have a distance, opticals, antenna design, and frequency. And so there is no simple ratio, but you got it right. Okay, simple question number two, I have only a few of them. How many times does the radio wave travel around the Earth in 1 second? And to XG.
WS2N, I got it.
Yes, Paul.
Number is 7.
That is correct. So that would be 133.13 milliseconds to travel once around the Earth. with the speed 200,000 kilometers per second. I'm sorry, I don't know about miles. European guy. But anyhow, beautiful. Now we have something that we ham radio operators experience. We have a long delayed echoes, LDEs. What those long delayed echoes are coming from? And to XGN.
I don't get the question, Roy and Wes. I don't get the question.
Okay. If let's say the signal traveled around the earth and you were able to hear it with the delay, you have an echo. But we have something like very, very, very long echo. And that would be 2.7 seconds, so longer than 2.7 seconds, the echoes are being named long delayed echoes, LDEs. Where they are coming from?
Are you talking about transmitting and then hearing your own echo? Is that what you're talking about?
That is correct.
Okay, you know, that's common. Well, not common, but some people are lucky enough to do that at least once or twice in their ham radio career. We, you know, you transmit your call, and all of a sudden you start hearing it coming back a second or so later. You know, it went around the earth and back again, back to you.
Yeah, so many times we have guys who want to do moon bounce, and sometimes the signal goes through ionosphere and magnetosphere, and those multiple reflections create that echo. And that's why we have it. But usually it is a reflection from other bodies, like meteor rays, moon, or other planets. I wonder if in the history of communication with satellites, there was also mentioned somewhere that they have an echo. Paul, back to you.
Satellites in general, whether or not when they're transmitting, they'll hit the moon or, you know, or at Mars. You know, Mars is very common. You know, you have satellites around the planet, and they're transmitting on 80 meters, and they're bouncing signals off the surface all the time. So, you know, that's reflection right there. You know, I believe one frequency that they use, well, one band is around 80 meters, and it'll hit the surface and come back up, and they can tell whether it's, you know, solid, or hopefully they're looking for water or something. They do that on the moon, Mars, and of course on Earth all the time, you know, with countless satellites going around Earth, sending signals down and back, having them bounce off the surface. They could tell how high the water is, you know, from if the water's going down because of global warming, you know. They've been doing this for forever, as far as I can tell. Well, not forever, but decades. Back to you.
Thank you very much for that. So, another question is, what frequency is usually used for moon bounce? Those guys who use moon bounce, I have two transceivers, Kennedy 2000. One is the mobile version, where the display is separate from the body, and the other one is 10 with 2000 that is sitting on my desk. Actually, it's mounted under my desk. But anyhow, they already have a future that allows working with the moon bounce. So the question is, what frequencies are used for moon bouncing? Anybody wants to answer the question and to ask you?
Okay, I watched yesterday, and I believe yesterday was a moon bounce day, you know, moon bounce contest. But you know, I know the answer, so I don't want to give the answer. Maybe somebody else wants to do it. Back to you or Wes.
CAF2CC.
Go ahead.
Westwick, when they did the first Earth-to-Moon bounce, was its own United States military project, and it was done on VHF frequencies.
Thank you very much for that information. Well, usually it's 2 meters, 70 centimeters, and 23 centimeters that usually is done. Thank you for that. What type of ferrite is usually used for ant ferrite antenna? What is the most common one that is being used? Anybody wants to answer that?
How do you mean?
Yes, one more time.
Restate that question, please.
So we have an infrared antenna, and then we have a ferrite that we usually use. If we don't buy the infrared antenna, we decided that we want to make. What is the most common type of ferrite that is used with those antennas and to exist?
Well, I assume you're speaking HF. If it's HF, it would be a MiX-31 composite.
Yeah, maybe 31, but it is mentioned in literature in many sources. Ferrite 43, FT240-43 is commonly used for infrared antennas from 3 to 10 megahertz, and 61 is used if we think that more important for us is 15 and 10 meters, which supposedly should give us better efficiency and lower losses in those frequency ranges. Back to you.
Well, there's different chokes for different purposes, the different ferrite formulations for different applications. I mean, if you need, you know, a choke for a specific purpose, I could tell you which would probably be, like, best one. But if you look on either Mauser Electronics or you look at ferrite, FAIR-RITE, that they give you a list of frequencies and the ferrites that work most effectively.
Thank you for that information. It's extremely helpful. Yeah, from the old times, I remember we were looking at permeability, and the lower was the permeability, the lower frequency. I'm sorry. The higher was the permeability, the lower frequency was that ferrite was able to handle. But before that, that was a thermally transformer. But anyhow, interesting subject. It's very much, rich in knowledge for many people. I was even thinking about my own press and centering and doing the ferrite by myself. And I found that I don't have a place for it. But anyhow, what type of metals are made from? That's an interesting question. I have a friend from Florida. And he was working on the street, and he found about 40 pounds of medals. So we're talking about Olympic gold medals, marathon medals, and the question is, what those metals are made from? Medals are made from. Somebody with 40 pounds of medals on the street for recycling. Unbelievable. Anybody knows? Okay, no answer. Okay. So it's trying to find out, and of course I do have EDMR, energy dispersive X-ray spectroscopy device in my lab. I don't use it pretty often because it requires for me to go to the lower floor and tune all of the devices in my liquid nitrogen farm, because that device requires liquid nitrogen for cooling in order to be able to work. But instead of doing all of that, I don't have those metals, and the guy is in Florida, so I was just trying to find it out and Google for it, and I found that Olympic medals, let's say gold medal, is made from 92.5 silver, and then it's plated with 6 grams of pure gold. So silver medals are made from 92.5 silver. And bronze medals are made from copper and other alloys. Then I asked him, what color is that? And he said, you know what, it looks like stainless steel. I said, what? Yeah, well, so the goal for those guys who make those medals was to make those medals so they do not rust. Can we call it steel? Okay, can we call it that is corrosion resistant? Because marathon medals are typically made from silver, bronze, some of gold, and there is one which I do not know how to pronounce it properly. Maybe Dr. Roy would help me. P-E-W-T-E-R. Again, P-E-W-T-E-R. Dr. Roy, back to you.
Pewter.
Yeah, pewter. Thank you very much. Pewter. With bronze being the most common material used for many events, they may also be made from other metals like plastic or wood for specific designs. So it's all of the information for it, but pewter. I was interested with pewter, which I wasn't very much in knowledge with. Pewter has a bronze, the most commonly used material in it. It is 85 to 99% mixed with small amount of other metals like copper and antimony. It has been used for various items, including household goods. Pewter, what kind of household goods pewter is used for? That I don't know. Maybe you know, Roy.
I think once upon a time they made pans and such with it.
Oh, okay. Okay, but it looks like it was used for thousands of years. Pewter. I wasn't really very much...
I need a vacation.
...familiar with that. Anyhow, thank you very much. That's all for tonight, and I'll leave the
time for somebody else. Enter XA and finish. Thank you.
Okay, Doug. Thank you, as always, Wes, for your participation. Brian, was that you talking about needing a vacation?
No comment.
Okay, well, we got about 21 minutes, give or take, if anyone wants it. Once again, I'm working in a sweatbox, so if we cut it short, I'm not going to have a nervous breakdown. It's up to you guys. If you have something to talk about, comments, questions, what have you, feel free to ask. Otherwise, we'll move ahead.
Please do.
Okay. Anyway, please, thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I hope you'll be able to join us next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we do this all over again. Hopefully the weather will be a little cooler and my shack won't be 89 degrees. Anyway, stay safe, be well. And now I bring you Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Okay, Roy. Charlie, I don't have that much material, but here we go. WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Coming up on Wednesday of this week, there will be a partial solar eclipse in the New York City area. So it's not going to be like in 2024, you know, a solar eclipse that we had was a total. But this one's only going to be a little bite out of the sun, 8%. And it'll occur at 1:54, so roughly, you know, 2 p.m., of course, daytime, the solar eclipse. You know, if you want to see the total eclipse of the sun, you have to go up to Greenland or Nova Scotia or somewhere. And there was a song years ago, and they went up to Nova Scotia. See the total eclipse of the sun. Well, here we go. I guess you can always do that. Naturally, you can't stare at it. It will screw up your eyes. You know, you need to have some kind of filters. And I'm lucky enough to still have my old welding stuff here, so I use a number of or 12. They say 10 is okay. You know, it is, but it's still a little too much light that gets through on that. They have different numbers, you know, 10, 11, 12, and, you know, each number that goes up, it's logarithmic, but not to the number 10. It's to the number 2.7. So, for instance, if I go from a 10 to 11, it's really two times 2.7, roughly three times dark. The previous one. But, we'll check out the news. I'm sure they'll be talking about it. WS2.
Hi, Paul. It's Brian, KF2ZZ. How you doing?
Good, Brian. Very good. And, was that you that made the comment about the moon mounts?
Correct.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I just read something like that on the internet. I wonder if you saw the same thing where the military did it back in 1946.
There's a book that's available on the internet. I don't know if it's freely downloadable or if it's, I know they sell it on Amazon, and I know they have like a partial explanation for it. I'm trying to remember the name. It was called Project Something. I think it was Project Diane. Indiana. And if you look that up, it tells you about the U.S. military and their attempt, which was successful, using VHF to bounce signals off the moon.
And yes, it was Project Diana. That's right, I saw that, and then I researched deeper into it to see, try to find some of the details. And I think you said it was VHF, which is true. They did 111 megahertz. So, and at 3,000, they used 3,000 watts of power, which, you know, a lot to run, you know, something in that frequency range back then. But, yeah, they had a ring dipole antenna, they call it. It was, I think, 64 dipoles, you know, for that frequency. So, you know, let's call it 2 meters. I think they said it was 2.7, I think, meters. Well, it's called 2 meter antennas. 64 of these things mounted on this contraption that was about 100 feet in the air. So I wanted to find out what happened to this thing after they used it. And, you know, I don't think they used it for anything. It was actually built for this purpose because it was 1946. They said it was, you know, after the war, so they recycled some antennas that they were using and they put this thing together. So, yeah, that's what I came up with. I thought it was an interesting piece of information. I wasn't too sure if it was true until I started researching.
Oh, it's definitely true. Matter of fact, if you look up Project Diana, there's a lot of information on it. And I actually spoke with the wife of another ham who wrote the actual book. And her father worked for NASA. And, you know, he designed it or helped design it. And it was mounted around Colchester, New Jersey, which is not too far from, like, Fort Lee. And I think the tower is still up. And I think they put various electronics on it. And it was like an array, and they took that down, if I remember. And I don't think it was 3,000 watts. I'm not sure. Maybe you're right. I thought it was like about 200 watts because they were going VHF, and you need to go ahead and do that, you know, to obviously get out of the Earth's atmosphere to the moon. So we need to shoot out straight point to point, and I think that's what it was about.
Okay, very good. Yeah, there you go. And here we are all these years later, and we have hams doing it on a regular basis. Now they have the Whisperer, and you know, you don't need exotic equipment to do it anymore. Then that was pretty good for 1946. Yeah. And they received the signal. They saw it on an oscilloscope. You know. So they knew they had it a couple of, I think, 2.5 seconds later or something after hitting the moon. And then the antenna system that they had, it wasn't an ASL system. They could move it in the azimuth position, but in elevation wise, they couldn't raise it higher or lower. So they could only do moonbound experiments either, you know, in, when the moon was just coming up or just setting, you know, when it was low in the horizon, they couldn't move it. So you just, you know, they knew when to be doing it by where the moon was going to be. Interesting. They must have a lot of fun, these guys, doing it in 1946.
It was interesting. They actually did a whole bunch of experiments with RF, and there are people that do it now. I guess you get like a one or two time thrill out of it, like with an echo, and you know, that's about it. I'll keep in mind that the orbit of the moon around the Earth is not perfectly circular. And that's why you have a variance in that, but you wouldn't detect it, you know, like it was on an oscilloscope. Some of you might detect it, but, or other scientific means through mathematics, but it's 186,000 miles per second, roughly. So if you, you know, take that distance to, because there's like a, I think there's like a 20, 25,000 mile difference in the orbit of the moon against the Earth, right?
Just checking something here about my computer. Oh well, work on that later. Anyway, there was supposed to be a moon bounce yesterday contest. We'll read about that in future QST articles. Yeah, they did. I want to talk about this American that got shipped out of Antarctica. It was an American citizen in the American base down in Antarctica. So an emergency situation, they had to fly a plane in to go get him. Anyway, McMurdo Station. The guy must have got sick. I don't have any details, but they flew him out. And right now it's winter time down there, and it's very unusual to have an airplane fly in, you know, during the season. So the people are pretty much locked in down in Antarctica. But they did fly a jet in there and landed it on the ice and picked up this guy and brought him back to a hospital in New Zealand, which made me wonder how in the world we're going to treat a similar situation if we have a crew on the way either to the moon or even worse on the way to Mars. You know, you just can't go grab a sick crew member. Bring them back. You know, it would take 6 months or a year to get them back. But, you know, NASA's going to have to consider that in the future. You know, you're going to need a doctor or two on board with all kinds of equipment. You know, if something serious pops up. You know, we talked about this a while back when the astronaut got sick on the International Space Station. They had to bring them back. Same thing. So, anyway, apparently this guy's okay from what I heard, but still, you know, it's a strange situation. You know, you could do it here on Earth, and it's very difficult, you know, for this time of year, and impossible to do it, you know, if you're on the way to Mars.
So it's not, you know, whether it's summer or, you know, you have the daylight. Well, it's opposite, right? So you get 6 months of daylight and 6 months of total darkness. But, it's the conditions, you know, of landing, because they have to make a runway, they have to groom it, there has to be enough where it has enough traction for the plane to go ahead and apply brake.